All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. We're going to do something different today that is post in its entirety an episode I did with Dan Vitale in 2014. Now, the reason we're doing this is Dan passed away last week, and I don't know if anybody who listened to this, you know, outside of maybe hearing the episode that I did with him, really puts him into context. And I left the intro intact of the original episode. It was from March 2014. I recorded it in New York City. It was important for me to track Dan down and talk to him for a few reasons. And some of them I discuss with him, and some of them I discuss leading up to the episode. But in retrospect, given that so many people in my community are passing away, are dying, you start to think in a way like, you know, man, it's death is all over. It's always all over. Everybody dies, man. And you never know when it's going to happen. And there are certain ages where in your mind you think it's, well, that was, you know, he had a good life, or, you know, or that's tragic, or that was way too young. And people say that about 80-year-olds now. Like, that was, he was young for these times. I'm like, was he, though? But Dan was in his 60s, I imagine. I don't know his exact how old he was. I do know he had heart disease, and I do know that, his partner came home after being out of town and found him in the house. But the reason that I sought him out to begin with is that he was a very unique performer, a very unique comic, a very unique guy. You know, he was a guy that was poised to have everything, a career in show business, and blew it because of his own demons and how hard he was on himself, and how important, you know, stand-up was. It was ultimately, I think it was too important for him, you know, to really carry on with it in any consistent way. And you just don't meet too many performers like that. This guy, Dan, had this, like, explosive sensitivity about him. And he was hyper, you know, kind of present and always trying to work things out for himself, mentally, intellectually, doing the big work and whatnot. And I just remember watching him. When I watched him on stage, he wasn't struggling with performing, he was struggling with himself. And that was, you know, that in and of itself can be a funny disposition. But it was genuine. And he was one of these performers where, you know, every set meant something. That if he was going to go up there for 10 minutes, it had to land, it had to be deep, it had to resonate, it had to work for him and the audience in a deeper way than just getting laughs. The premium was on the depth of the humor and of what was being said. He had a true artist spirit about the thing. You know, he did get sober years ago, and we've stayed in touch. But it's one of these situations where, you know, a lot of times I have these conversations with people, and then they pass away, and then I repost them. And my connection with them may have been just as deep as that conversation. And then there are people that, for whatever reason, even if it's not much more than that conversation, have had a deep impact on my life in my process of sort of putting myself together from scratch, from the ill-defined sort of fragmented self that I was sent off into the world with. And Dan was just one of those guys. You know, we did keep in touch, though. I texted him like two and a half weeks ago when I was in New York, and he didn't get back to me, but then he left a voicemail. He had changed phones, and we seemed to like just text on and off every few months, and always, you know, it was always funny. He was one of the first guys I went to when I actually, you know, wrote a joke or was trying to sort of work out a way to approach Lynn's death on stage. He was very supportive during my grief time. You know, he texted, checked in occasionally. But I remember he was the guy. I'm like, who can I tell this to? Who can handle this? You know, and who will I not feel weird and ashamed about telling me this joke that I came up with like a few weeks after Lynn passed away, which is now, you know, in my performance. It's in my act or in my show right now. And I reference Dan as, I don't say his name on stage, but I've been saying that I called this guy who I I knew was the Dark Buddha. He was the only guy I could tell at this moment. And that was Dan. And, you know, he laughed. And he was like, oh, my God, what are you going to do with that? And, well, I figured out a way, Dan. But oddly, we would text occasionally about people passing away. You know, he'd just send me a text about, he was making fun of the Sam Elliott thing. And recently, you know, we were talking about Dom Irrera, and I hooked him up with Dom, and, you know, they hadn't talked to each other in 20 years, and it was nice. He said, text says, I just had a long talk with Dom, a lot of laughs. Still sounds like he's got the spirit. Thanks for prodding me and his phone number. Love you, man. Then he texted me about William Hurt dying, and I said, yeah, man, you can only get away with life so long. He would text me when people died, you know, so I didn't get a text about him. But he just had a big impact on me, and I'll put him into context in the show, in the intro that you'll hear soon. And I'm here in Tulsa still, and I went to the Dylan Center yesterday, and it's so funny that we were, you know, he had left me this message about the In Memoriam thing that Lynn was in on the Oscars, and he texted me. Here's the he'd left a rambling message. I don't have it anymore. But he said, "Here's the Dylan lyric I was trying to quote. Quote: Time is a jet plane; it moves too fast. Oh, but what a shame if all we shared can't last." Unquote. And he said, "Dan says, you know, Mark, life has taught me you can learn a lot from Dylan, but you can also probably learn a lot from Carrot Top." He was a funny guy, a thoughtful guy. You know, this episode was from March 2014, but if you've been listening to the show for a while, you hear a lot of the familiar stuff that I always talk about. You know, the themes of my show, you know, about life and comedy and what I think stand-up comedy is, or what the, you know, what I think is important in stand-up comedy. And, you know, Dan and I talk about all that stuff. We talk about our love for Jackie Vernon, you know, comics that made sort of an impact on us when we were younger. And it's a very good sort of time capsule. It's a good episode sort of exemplifying, you know, what we were trying to do with this show, with WTF, and what I was able to get out of it personally for myself by connecting with people, especially people that, you know, I hadn't talked to or seen or heard from in a while. But as a guy, you know, Dan Vitale wrote a couple of the best jokes I ever heard in my life because they were so real and so resonant and so fucking deep. It was satisfying. He was a real fucking artist, this guy. And he really just couldn't, he just fought the fight, and it was hard for him to get up there. But I just wanted to give him this tribute, and also to, you know, post this episode again, you know, on a regular show day. But I love the guy, you know, and again, it's weird. I can't explain it. It's not like we spent a lot of time together, but it was a time when I was very impressionable, and it was very important. Comedy was very important to me, and what and how to do it. And I just always, the guy just was somehow part of my heart. You know, it's like Saget. You know, I didn't know that guy that well, but he was somehow connected to part of my heart. And in a dark way, you know, it was like this thing I said on the last episode. I'm in Tulsa, you know, and Kennison is buried here, and you know, and that guy really kind of profoundly hurt me when I was younger. Yeah, because I'm a sensitive guy. That's why we do comedy. And you know, he kind of terrorized me and really kind of fucked me up. And it was all very specific. And I wanted to have the last word. I'd spoken kind of glibly about, you know, going to his grave and peeing on it because I owed him that. And I thought about that for years. But, you know, I went out there and I got to the grave and, you know, and I knew I wasn't going to do it. But I didn't know that I would find forgiveness in my heart for that guy and actually have a few laughs and think about, you know, some of the amazing experiences I had at that time in my life, given they were drug-fueled insanity, and that things got out of control. But I got a lot of good laughs and a lot of good stories, and whatever trauma I had has dissipated and been resolved, and I was able to, you know, find forgiveness for a fairly brutal dude. But that's what happens, you know, if you live long enough and you put death into perspective, and you know, you really put your own selfish sort of emotions into perspective. But that's just a reflection on death and the death around me and as I get older. But this guy, Dan Vitale, was, you know, truly a force of nature, a real hot frequency. And I, you know, I reached out to his partner, who I hadn't seen in years and I really haven't talked to, just to express my condolences and say, you know, let me know if there's anything I can do to help, which is, you know, such a, it's not an empty gesture, because I would if I could, and if there was something, you know, someone needed, I would do it, but it's just something you say. And she said something. She said, "I'm okay, just can't get used to the world without Dan Vitale." And that's, you know, that's an intimate relationship, but that's sort of what happens. The absence, whatever your relationship with somebody who has passed away, somebody that was part of you somehow, you know, you're always going to, you know, the relationship becomes with an absence and the weight of that. Rest in peace, Dan Vitale. I loved you. Here's my conversation with Dan Vitale from March 2014, including the introduction. Dan Vitale. Let me tell you about Dan Vitale. Dan Vitale was a force to be reckoned with. When I got to New York in the late 80s, 1989, the original improv was one of the only places that, you know, I could work. The original improv, what was left of it up there on 44th Street was, you know, Bud Friedman had left and built his empire. And the original improv, where everything started, was under the control of Bud's ex-wife, Silver Friedman, who ran the place and managed it, to micromanaged it down to your act, to who you were, to who she let on, and to what she, you know, she had things to say about you. But it was sort of a beat-up place, and it kind of had the vibe that it was on its last legs. But it was the original improv, so it had that the sort of history to it, and it had, you know, all these, you know, weird old pictures, and, you know, it was the place. It was the original club. It was the original brick wall. The original improv on 44th Street was a small room. The chairs were beat up. The sign on the wall, on the hanging on the brick wall that said the improvisation was missing a letter. All the chairs were, you know, some of them were built into the wall. It might have, it probably seat less than 200 people in there. It was a tight little room with a front bar, and it just looked like it was beat up. All, it wore all the history right on the chairs, right on the walls. Every, we felt it all. It wasn't haunted. It was just a little bit beat up, and it felt like it was almost over. But being able to work there, you kind of felt like, well, at least I'm catching the tail end of this. At least I've stood in front of the original brick wall, the first one, where it all started, you know, where all the people in New York, you know, started to come, you know, back in the early 70s or late 60s. It was, it, you felt it all. But when I got there, there was this dude, Dan Vitale. I never heard of him. I didn't know who he was. But he was one of these guys that a sort of mythological tale surrounded him. You know, at the time, he was very heavy. You know, he'd get up on stage, and he was one of the first guys I'd ever seen get up on stage and literally look at an audience and go, "You know what? Yeah, I don't know if we're going to get along. I don't know if we're going to hit it off." And he would just wrestle with himself on stage. I'd never seen anything like it. There was, you know, this amazing sort of bombastic sort of wit and confidence mixed with this utter, complete angry insecurity. It was fascinating to me that he could let himself be that way on stage, and that he was that way off stage too. He just struggled with himself. But he had brilliant jokes. I've quoted some of the jokes on this show, you know, to other people and talking to Dom Irrera. But I just used to love watching this guy and hang around this guy, because I'd never seen someone so actively struggling with himself, you know, with his past, you know, with substances, with everything. But the story was that, you know, he was the next big guy. He was that guy. You know, he was really the first story that, it was the first time I ever heard that story. We're like, yeah, man, he was poised to be the guy at, you know, for Lorne Michaels. Lorne Michaels took a shine to him, and he got the shot, and he just blew it because he couldn't control his personality or his substances or anything. He just blew it, and then he fell hard. And this is what's left of him. And I loved what was left of him, because it was so brutally raw and human and honest, yeah, in a way that you know, being humbled gives you. You can fight being humbled, but if you are humbled, you know, you can't hide it. You can fight it, but you can't hide it. It's tough to find grace in that. I guess grace is a theme. But I was sort of obsessed with Vitaly, and then there was that period there. I remember there was this one time, you know, Bill Hicks lived in New York for about a day, maybe less than a year. He just decided to move here. He was doing sets at the Improv. No one really understood Hicks. You know, he just blew that room apart. You know, and Vitaly and Hicks were buddies. I mean, they became friends. And, you know, and then we used to sit and watch. Like, I remember one time I sat and watched Brian Regan with Bill Hicks, and Vitaly was there. And I just remember this one time where me and Bill Hicks and Dan Vitaly, it was New Year's Eve, and we were at the Improv. We had nothing to do, no parties, no nothing. And we were like three blocks away from where the ball drops. And I'd never seen it. I never wanted to go over there. I never wanted to fucking deal with the massive crowds and all the bullshit. But Hicks had never seen it. So me and Vitaly are standing there, and Hicks is like, let's go, man. Let's go see it. And I'm like, dude, we're not even going to get close to it. I mean, we were on 44th and like between 8th and 9th, and it's happening at 42nd in, you know, Times Square. And there were people already backed up to almost to where we were. But Hicks is like, man, I got to see it. I got to see it. And we went out. I just remember the three of us, you know, these fucking rogue comedians, you know, friendless and without definition life-wise, other than our gypsy existence. We're trying to plow through the essence of mainstream culture, you know, to get to watch this spectacle. And we got about a block, and we didn't know what to do. We couldn't move. It was horrible. And Hicks is just sort of like, ah, fuck this. Let's go back to the Improv and do the countdown. So we wandered back and just, you know, sat there and waited for New Year's to happen. The three of us, in my memory, were just alone in the bar at the Improv, you know, waiting for New Year's to happen. It's a beautiful New York sort of, you know, sad but kind of pretty moment, you know. But Vitaly, man, I've always had a big place in my heart for him. And I'm very thrilled that, you know, I was able to talk to him, and I hope you enjoy this conversation. This conversation with Dan Vitaly took place at the London Hotel. I don't think I had sat down and talked to Dan in over 20 years. Over 20 years. I think I ran into him once in that time. But he looks good. He's a, you know, specifically New York character. And you know, it had a profound effect on my life, and I was thrilled to talk to him. So this is me and Dan Vitaly.
No, I tell you the truth. I was thinking when I was walking through, like, the last time I stayed in any kind of decent hotels, it's like I'm in my 50s. So it's really like my late 20s.
Yeah.
Maybe I caught a couple in my early 30s. I was getting like the last of like the good television work that was coming my way.
Yeah.
And sad to say, my only reference is that I would come in looking kind of like crazed.
Yeah.
And, you know, because it's like what I would do is, I knew that I was, like, say, I was a featured player on SNL, so I knew I was getting, like $1,800 a week.
Yeah.
So I'd go up to Broadway Video, and I'd wait for, like, Lauren's secretary, and I would come up with some story about, you know, a sick relative, and Con Ed's closing me off. And so I'd get an advance of, like, a couple of thousand.
Yeah.
And I'd go, like, well, I can't really be around, like, people I know, because I knew it was to come, you know? So I would go check in. I'd go, okay, let me just get a nice hotel room. I'll do my ugly business, whatever that's going to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd always walk in. They always had like that, I'm sure they have one here, you know, like that security place where you could go, like, I'd like to leave some valuables. So no matter how much I got, like say I got $5,000, I would take like $2,000 in the pocket and put $3,000 in the box downstairs. Like,
yeah.
That nobody touches that. And then I'd, you know, call up some, you know, like, you know, degenerate coke dealer or pick up some denizen of the street. And then, like, within, like, you know, 20 hours, I'd be down there, like, sweating with, like, some concierge trying to talk me out of going to the... So it's like I never really got that experience of sitting there and
bro, like, having some coffee.
Yeah, and having, like, the nice room service.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I moved to New York, I guess it was 89. I was living on the Lower East Side, and Silver passed me at the original Improv.
Yes, on original.
44th Street, which at that point in 89 was like a decaying, it had seen its day.
Well, I'll tell you. Okay, go ahead.
So I come in and, you know, like I think Kevin Brennan was working the door. I don't think Attell was working the door. Maybe.
No, Attell was working
the door. I don't know if he was when I got here. I think he would done that thing. Maybe Stu Kamen's.
think he was just getting off the door.
Right.
Yeah.
And you were around, and Brett Butler was living here at that time, and you were this guy that, you, to me, you know, I didn't know who you were. But at that time, it's like, that's Dan Vitale. And you were like, you know, you were up there sweating and you're working some shit through. And all I know is that they were like, oh, yeah, he was on SNL. And then it just all went bad.
It's true. Yeah, which is true, by the way. But I mean, yeah,
but
go
like,
ahead.
You know, I walk in and you're doing this great comedy. I still quote fucking jokes of yours.
I give you credit for that. Thank you.
The sort of when you hit bottom, you'd be surprised at how much give that floor has. Like, it had a profound effect on me. But I don't think I ever really got the backstory. There was that time, 89 to 91, 92, I was here. Hicks was here for about six months.
Yeah.
But I met you before that. And you were volatile. Like, yeah. you were in and out of sobriety, but you just never knew when you were going to lose your shit. And then, like, you know, you get to the improv, it's like, oh, yeah, fucking Dan last night. But what
like I went from, like, in other words, it was no longer just about the comedy at that point. I'd become like sort of almost like a spectacle of some sort.
I didn't see it necessarily, but you heard about it. Yeah. Like, it's like when Dan got there, you're like, all right, we'll see what happens.
All right, I could give you the chronology.
Right.
If you need that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know what, man, I wanted to be a comedian. Like, you know, I grew up, you know, Queens, Long Island. And then, like, in the late 70s, I just went like, you know what, man? I'm going to go to New York City, and I'm going to do something, be an actor, be a comedian,
yeah,
be a hipster poet. Easter, I don't know, something. So I came
You grew up in Queens?
I was born in Queens. I mostly grew up in Long Island, man.
Italian family?
Italian-Irish.
Yeah.
Yeah, crazy family, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mother was, you know, like, all the things that we know about, like, my mother was, like, a blackout drunk.
Yeah.
You know, running like pharmaceuticals with the Seagrams long before it became hip.
Right.
You know, like now it's almost hip.
Yeah.
To be in, you know, like, he just got out of rehab. You know, right. He's got some demons.
Yeah.
You know, my old lady had those demons on, like, you know, like, you know, middle class Long Island, you know, man. Yeah. But I mean, I'm not trying to make it funny. It actually ended very bad. It ended very poorly. Yeah. That it really took her down and it busted up my family. But even then, you know, I'll tell you the truth, man. Even though there was like a real like a real darkness around the family, there was also a lot of like dark laughter.
Sure.
And I got a feeling that's where I kind of got, like, you know, the beginning of like my vision. Like, it was like my family isn't like all the other families.
You
on
can't sell that.
Pin Oak Lane,
right,
man.
Right,
you know.
Right. What was your dad doing?
He was a very interesting guy. He'd had some. He'd had some issues himself in the, I would say in the, I don't really know the specifics, but
yeah.
I'm sure that illegality,
yeah.
There was some like pending charges or something that, you know, like where it was like, when I was like seven, not quite eight, I just remember like a cardboard box being thrown into my room. You know, I'm laying there with like a little, you know, one of them jackets with like the Yankee pennants on it and all. And it was like, put your stuff in the box. We're moving. It was like, and the next thing I know, man, we were like in Florida. And like, my parents were managing a motel. But it was like, it was weird, man. Oh, by the way, I remember I was just telling somebody, it's funny that I was talking to somebody the other night. It's the first time I remember this in a lot of years.
Yeah.
Like, my family decided that since everything was blowing up in New York City, the solution to the problem somehow was going to Florida.
Yeah.
So we all went down to Florida, and it all, like, it just, it didn't happen. And the next thing I know, I was being flown back to live with my aunt or something. And then I remember, like, a couple of years went by, and they went, let's try that again. And like this like the same thing. Oh, but I'll tell you something really interesting. And it's actually this week.
Yeah.
The day that I flew back. This is the only thing I truly remember. I will never forget this. The day we flew out of Miami back to New York City, it was February. It had to be February 9th, 1964, because there I was getting at the airport and there was bedlam and there was insanity. I landed at, it wasn't called JFK then. What was it? Was it Idlewild then?
I don't know.
I landed at the airport the same day the Beatles landed, man. And they were doing the Sullivan Show that night.
Right.
So I was sitting in my Uncle Rocky's that night watching the Beatles. But I was in the airport that day. I mean, it was pretty pretty amazing historic little, you know. I always kind of like brushed and rubbed elbows with history. Never quite got to it, you know. Like, I never really quite got to
be
the...
You were in the corner of the picture.
Yeah.
Who's that kid?
Yeah.
There's that kid again.
That little fat kid. You know, I think Lennon said he had a vibe on me.
Yeah.
That little fat kid. I think he's going to grow up and abuse drugs like myself.
All right, so your mom was out of control and your dad was dubious.
And yeah, he was a great guy, and I mean, he held the family together. I'm just saying, like, this wasn't, father knows best.
Yeah, so I get it.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot, you know, actually.
You got brothers and sisters?
Yeah, they're gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dead?
Yeah, dead. Yeah, I'm the survivor. You know, I tell you the truth, though, man, I used to, like, kind of hold that as, like, a. Like, I'm the survivor. It's true. Everybody died in my family. Like, and actually, even, like, obviously, my brother and sister died. I don't really want to dwell on the tragedy aspect. I will if you want me to, but for the...
Was it all the same shit?
Yeah, it was pretty dark stuff. No, actually, I mean, well, I'll tell you in a nutshell, man. Like, my mother stayed in Florida.
Yeah.
And so, like, when I was 12, it was, like, Christmas. My sister was going to go visit her. And she got killed by a drunk driver at the airport going down to visit her.
Mm-hmm.
You know what, man? Like, that was, like, sort of, for all intents and purposes, like, the end of, like, childhood.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, at that point, I started seeing the world in a much, even, like, at 13 or 14, like, I started being drawn into, like, you know, I just saw the world in a darker way.
Okay,
I lost all my...
Right.
I in fact had any childhood idealism or
innocence,
innocence. And it's like, you know, I've often thought about that, like, because it's like, it wasn't until like years ago, like I kind of like locked that down, all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
In my childhood, I kind of like just like closed the door on it and went like, okay, you know what? That closet will never be open. Actually.
I'm going to close the closet, but I'm going to let what's in there dictate my life.
But I will tell you a funny story. My father had a little coffee shop for a while. Like, it was an alleged business. And there was, like, you know, there was actually, like, a Long Island Railroad, like, sort of, like, a couple hours in the morning where they sold a lot of coffee and stuff.
Yeah.
Some breakfast.
Donuts.
But they were, like... The rest of the day was like, you know, like very suspect guys hanging out with my father using the payphone. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, and there was a topless bar across the street. And so the strippers used to come in and hang out. And so I got to know, like, you know, I was like, you know, trying to grab a few bucks out of the till. This is like from my teens, like through high school.
Yeah.
So I didn't really like have a job work. I was just like, I'd show up and maybe, like, help out for, like, an hour in the morning.
Yeah.
Then I'd go to school, and then, like, if I wasn't too stoned, I'd come back and, like, mop the floor. But there was no, like, you know, salaries. This was just, like, my father said to me, kid, there's the till. You need some, you grab it. You know what I mean? That was, like, he was famous. He had a very laid-back philosophy.
Not on the books.
My old man would, like, he'd hang his pants, like, over the chair, and then he'd go sit. He'd stare at this like black and white TV, and he'd just be watching TV, and he'd just be chain smoking, and he would drink coffee all. I don't know how it didn't affect him that he could possibly sleep. I mean, there's guys on crystal meth that aren't as amped up. And then he would just go like, "Hey, kid, don't you know what? We don't have that kind of thing. You got to come to me. Just if you need something, that's it. There's no bank accounts. There's no nothing.
The drawer.
It's there. It's in the pants. In other words, just go in the pants. If it ain't there, there's no looking. You know. So
that's the extent of the savings.
Yeah. So, that was it. There was no CDs, the certificates of deposit or nothing. Anyway, I get it in my head. That I'm going to be, you know what, you got to understand something. Like, I'm not that much older than you, but a little bit.
I'm 50.
All right, I got you by about 7 years.
Yeah.
So, you remember like when do you remember Freddie Prinze hitting it on The Tonight Show?
Kind
of. That's the thing, man. That was like a big deal for like a lot of people, I think, my age, was that suddenly this 19-year-old kid went out on The Tonight Show and instantly became an overnight sensation.
Yeah.
And so, like, I had it in my head, I'm going to go to the Improv, I'm going to be a comedian, and I'm going to be
famous. He was still in New York then.
Freddie?
Yeah.
I didn't know him. I mean, I was just a teenager.
But he started here.
Yeah, I think he grew up here. He started at the Improv.
Right. How old?
Oh, God. I was like a teenager, like 16, 17, 17. Yeah.
And you made the decision. You were like...
Yeah, because I was always a funny kid, man. Yeah. It was like something I always wanted to do. But I think up until then, my definition of a comedian was more like... And which still isn't a bad definition. It was like Don Rickles, Rodney.
Yeah. No, they're great.
Yeah. And the guys from The Tonight Show and The Ed Sullivan Show. Yeah,
like, because we're like-minded in that. It's like, in my heart, you know, and I was just talking to some other guy about this. Those were the guys that put it in me. Do you know, like, right. I mean, those in whatever I wanted to do or whatever, you know, pursuit of truth I had or whoever my heroes were later in life, they were usually heroes because, like, oh, they're on the edge, man. They're pushing the envelope. But, you know, you go back to those guys, even Rodney, who was underappreciated, they're the fucking best.
Yeah, and actually, if you look back now, you realize that, like, yeah, they weren't wearing the hipster clothing.
Right.
And they weren't, like, you know, there was nothing. But, like, if you really look at it, man, it was the pure soul.
Yeah, they were out of control,
the pure soul of a comedian.
They were having a great time.
I had a friend of mine who told me that Rodney, apparently, at one point, somebody of mine was out there. He was writing films and stuff. He told me that Charlie Sheen had an apartment. And Rodney had the apartment upstairs.
Yeah.
And that they'd be having parties. And then, like, Rodney would come down. And I'd be like, he had to be, like, 80 in his 80s.
Oh, yeah.
But he was like.
Well, that's what he hit when he was, like, 70, you know, because of the movies. Right.
Didn't you tell me? I think it was you. For some reason, I remember, like, the things that you were, like, at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, you were just kind of new. You were hanging out. And all of a sudden, a cab pulled up.
Yeah.
And Rodney stuck his head out and went, where's Sam?
Yeah.
He was, like, in his 70s.
Oh, yeah. He used to get out. You know, he'd have his own drink. He'd be in a bathrobe. There's a great story that, who was it? Oh, Carl LeBeau told me. You'll love it. That, you know, because, you know, Sam confided in Rodney. And Rodney, they were kindred spirits. So there was a lot of, you know, after Rodney put him on the special and put him in Back to School, you know, that, you know, Sam really looked at him as a mentor and as a guy who gave him his break.
Sure.
But apparently, like, one time, you know, Sam been up 3 days, he was fucked up, he was at the house, and, you know, he's at the end of a 3-day run, and Rodney walked into the house and said, "Ooh, look at little Nero."
That's pretty good.
Look at little Nero.
I just remember Rodney used to come into the Improv. And he'd pull up in, like, a limo or, like, you know, he'd have, like, a driver.
Yeah.
And then this is, like, in the early 90s.
Yeah.
He would come in, and he was wearing, like, and it hadn't be, it was, like, you know, guys would wear those little, like, waist bags.
Fanny packs.
Yeah. And then he'd go, "Well, where's the men's room, kid?" And he'd go in there. He'd go up on stage, and I'd be like, "I think he's wired, man." Like, the guy was, like, 65 or 70. And he got up there, and what I remember was, like, you know, like, I, like, even though I had, like, some, you know, I made some moves in my life. I've been around some bit.
Yeah.
But, like, I've always been a little bit in awe of celebrity.
Yeah.
I always have
been. Sure, me too. Yeah.
So, I'd be like, you know, the manager would go, like, listen, just bring, ask Rodney what you want, what he wants you to say, and then just bring him right up. So, I'd be like, Rodney, just tell him I'm a friend of the club, wants to go up and say. So I was like, "Oh, this is gonna be great! I'm emceeing. I'm gonna watch Rodney." And he would go up, and the handful of times that I saw him at the Improv, it was like a completely different Rodney. Like, remember Rodney with that great character, that wonderful
twitchy
and sort of like self-effacing.
Yeah.
And then those brilliant one-liners.
Yeah.
And he would go up and he would grab the mic and he started like working the crowd. He'd be like, "Yeah, look at this guy over here. This bald fuck." And I was like, he was like suddenly working like Rickles, like an insult comic. And I guess it was just like, I don't know if he was high. He had a couple of, but like, I guess he just needed to get his thing out. Like, in other words, like, "Hey, I don't want to always be so perfect. You know, I have to get these girls." But I just remember watching it. He'd go up, "Look at this one over here. Yeah. Where'd you meet this putain?" Yeah. And then like, he'd go, "All right, thanks a lot." Yeah. And of course, the people were just like, they couldn't believe that for the price they were paying, they saw Rodney. Yeah. So they were thrilled. But I remember, like, what was the point? Like, in other words, like, you're working on that? Like,
right.
But
you know, and now as an older guy, you know that, you know, he just needed to get up there.
Well,
Who the hell knows? Yeah. I mean, maybe there was 12 people in the room. What's he going to do?
I mean, I hear you. Oh, actually, I mean, listen, I've never, I've never, like, I've done some, you know, I've had moments where I was like, you know, I could work some mainstream comedy, and but I've never gotten past the point. My favorite thing on planet Earth is to work in front of like 12 people that are scattered around, and half of them don't really want to be there. And then, like, if you could somehow lure them in, you know, man,
it's a victory.
Yeah.
It's better than like killing with a full room.
Well, I you know what, man?
You used to open your set with, like, you know, I got a feeling we're not going to.
Yeah, you know what's funny? I heard you say that. That's how we actually got in touch, because a buddy of mine called me up. He goes, hey, listen, man, it was bizarre. I was up at like 6 in the morning, and I was at my buddy's. I guess he had a link to Jim Norton, and so then Norton was on your podcast. Yeah. So he went and listened, and he goes, he's playing me your podcast. And I got like a cell phone from like, you know.
Right.
And I'm listening. So that guy, I call him up. He goes, they were talking about you on Matt. So I guess you and Dom were talking about me at the South by Southwest.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I listened. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool, man. These guys remember. So then the next day, I moved. I moved from a building. I moved into another better building across the street. So I was moving, and I like knew how to throw a bunch of stuff out. So I keep stuff in boxes.
Yeah.
So like I was going through a box. It's like, I got, this is all like comedy material and stuff and phone numbers I'm never going to use. And I found this little scrap of paper, and it said Mark Maron and a 917 number. Yeah. And I went, and my friend was sitting there right with me, and I went, what are the chances this guy would still have this number? I haven't seen him. She went, well, take a shot. And I immediately hit it. You just answered like as if we'd been talking. Yeah. Yeah. I was like, Mark? So, yeah, but I do remember you said that on the podcast. You went, yeah, he would go up and start by going,
I don't think we're going to get along.
I guess I did that sometimes. But I think, you know what, I actually thought that you might have had me confused with, like, Larry David.
No, I didn't.
Because he would actually.
You would get up, though. No, I remember it. You would do maybe one joke, and it would be like, all right.
Yeah. Well, I did have a very low threshold for, like, in other words, like. Like, I guess if you're a really professional comedian of any, or seasoned on any level, you would assume that a guy who'd been doing it, like, for off and on 10, 15 years would know that, especially given, like, the lateness of the spot and the randomness of the audience, that maybe the first line isn't going to kill, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, I would go up, but you know what? I was so, like, I was kind of crazy in those days because it was like, I guess I could perform, so I wasn't at my worst, like, in terms of, like, using stuff. But I clearly wasn't, like, completely sane.
But I think that I think what we share is that there, for some reason, when you get up there, in that moment, a lot hinges on it. You don't feel like you're entertaining. You're sort of like, you know, this is everything that I've been is happening right now. And it's all hinging on your approval for some fucked up reason.
I know. Well, and actually, I think we might actually be even more similar in this regard. For some reason, like over the years, maybe it's like my Italianness or something. And I used to slick back my hair and go smoke. For some reason, a lot of people were under the impression that I was like some cool guy who'd seen a lot, like who'd seen a lot of life. Yeah, right. And like, oh, nah, this guy, he's been to the other side.
Right.
And in some ways, that's true.
Right.
But I don't think that I ever took the stage as a comedian, ever, that I didn't approach, as my hand first held the microphone and looked at the audience, that I wasn't like some scared,
terrifying
little prom girl who just want, I so need your love. Oh, please.
Immediately.
Yeah. I was Judy Garland, man. I was Shirley.
The weird thing is that that's what we're feeling, but there's nothing but rage in our eyes.
No. And the weird thing is, like, at least you have like the cool kind of, like, you know, you've always had like a cooler look because you got the glasses, and, you know.
It's all
but
bullshit.
Like me, man, like from the 80s to the 90s, like I put on 100 pounds.
Yeah.
So I went from like looking like sort of like a De Niro in Mean Streets to like Tony Salerno, you know. So it, like, it even seemed crazier that this big Italian fucking aggressive guy
would be so,
like,
sensitive.
People didn't really know. Like the last thing they were thinking was like, he really needs us to support him. We need, you know, it's like, and that's all, man. You know, see, the thing about me is that, like, comedy and, like, my life, and it's why it's always so hard, like, when I stopped doing it, it's always so hard for me to go back because like comedy was never just like some art form or business thing. Like, hey, you're pretty good at this. You might be able to make a few. Yeah. It was always like the thing that defined me, like where I was working out my thing.
Yeah, me too. Like, you know, it's like it was life or death in some weird way.
So it's like a war that like, you remember that movie Black Hawk Down?
Yeah.
I always remember this, man. You saw it?
Yeah.
You remember at the end when they finally get through the thing and the guys are shooting? God, you shot in the neck. And they finally get back to the compound and they're back and they're bleeding. And one guy goes over and he starts grabbing ammo, putting stuff. And I think it's Josh Hartnett, if I remember, the actor. And he goes, what are you doing? He goes, we're going back. There's still a couple of vans there. He goes, we're going back. I'm not going back. What are you, crazy? And the guy just looks at him and goes, yeah, well, you could go back or not, but you'll live with it the rest of your life. And then I'm not even sure if he goes back. And I hope he didn't, actually. Yeah. But for me, man, like comedy's always been some sort of like on some level, like a war with myself. Yeah. I was never a war with the audience.
Yes.
I was never a war with the club guys. That was just an excuse, you know?
Right.
But
and that's what they're watching, though. I'm the same way, and that must be why I'm so compelled towards you, is that, you know, they're watching a guy like, I don't know who's going to win here with you. Like, who's going to win that war that's going on stage with that one guy?
Yeah. Right. This is so interesting that you asked me this, because I was thinking about this.
Yeah.
It's like, the thing is that the best comedy that I ever did, see, like, I got known, like, you remember some of my bits.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, Dom was reminding you of a bit. Right. And, like, there's bits that people remember of mine. Like, I could write, but my best stuff was when I was working and I just, and this developed over years. It didn't just happen. Right. And in fact, it developed to the point where when I stopped performing in like mainstream clubs, like I'd be doing like the later days of Rocky Sullivan's with Credico, where it would just be me, him, and like John Marshall, and there were like a dozen people who listened to BAI,
but
they would show up every week,
right?
And then like a handful of stragglers, But this was like the end days, like all the guys with, you know, like real names that were happening were gone, and so. Randy, I had gone to like my last rehab in like 2005. Yeah. And when I came out, Randy was still going. So I was like, I had nothing going. So I started going to Rocky Sullivan's on a Tuesday night. And Randy would be like, hey, I'd be like Whitney Brown or Barry Crimmins might show up once in a blue moon.
Right.
But mostly it was me and Randy. And he'd go, well, just go up and do your thing, man. Go ahead. So like I hadn't performed for a couple of years and I was again trying to reclaim my sobriety. So, of course, there was that first night where I'm doing, like, a set list, like, transvestite, Italian guys, like, as if I needed to remember that.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I'd start talking about, like, where I'd been the last couple of years. And then suddenly I'd see, like, oh, everybody got their attention.
Because it's real.
And then week after week, and finally got to the point, man, where I was doing, like, 45 minutes to an hour. And I'm telling you, Mark, maybe 5 minutes was stuff I thought about.
Yeah.
The rest was all off the top of my head.
The best.
But this had been developing over years where I knew, and it's like, it's kind of like a trick. It's like a magic trick that you really can't like sell to any casino. Like, here's the thing.
Yeah.
I don't know how I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
But if you let me do this.
It might happen.
But there's a chance it doesn't. And it's like, well, what do I do?
That's it. Like, here's the pitch. I'm very inconsistent. It's really hit or miss.
I can't guarantee you nothing.
But if I hit, it's going to be great for me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Hey, where are you going with that? Who are you selling that to? What agent is going? Dan, sit down.
Yeah.
I've been thinking hard on this. This whole, I don't have an act. I don't know where. I'm going to back you up. Yeah, really. But you know what it is, too, man? But the reason I say this is.
But that is a victory in the war that you're talking about. That the war with yourself when you.
Yes. Oh, absolutely, Mark. Yeah. I got to tell you, but you know what? I know this might sound like the height of hubris for me to be saying this, but.
You have to earn that.
Yes, I have. I've become, by not caring, I've become a way better comedian than from the days when I was really like trying to like, what time's Marin on?
Yeah.
10:50?
Oh, fuck.
Who's got the next spot?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Okay, I can understand a tell, but I should be on before Manfredi. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Like, what? Yeah. Stu Kamen says to midnight?
Yeah.
I'm, you know, but like I was trying to to find my way in the mainstream of things. And it's like, yeah, it would have been great if it worked out. I'd have a great, like, AFTRA pension now.
But I don't think we were trying to find our way in that. I think we were trying to find ourselves. I think that's some weird thing about me because, like, I'm in the same way. I didn't have, like, you know, a plan. I just wanted to be a fucking comedian on my own terms.
Right.
And I really didn't even take into mind the fact that, like, I wasn't even that concerned with entertaining.
You know, right.
You know what I mean? It's just sort of like, if this hits, if I hit it, it's going to be great for everybody, right?
Right.
So let's just see if that happens.
Now, I do remember this. Yeah. Like, when I met you, I'd say that's around 90-ish, early 90s. At the same time, Hicks had been around, but that's the first time that I became friends with him. Because he was in New York.
You and I and him went
tried to get to Times Square one
on
night.
New Year's.
Yeah, that was the closest I ever came to it.
Yeah, we got
didn't
about
get
two
into
blocks.
The crowd. Yeah, I'm glad we didn't.
And we ran back to the fucking improv.
Right. Didn't we go see Silence of the Lambs or something?
I don't know if we did. Maybe you guys did. I don't remember going to the movies with him.
But I remember, like, me and Hicks hit it off, and we had, like, a real mutual respect society, you know?
Yeah.
And, but I gotta tell you, like, if I ever saw a guy who was less concerned. See, I gotta tell you something. I actually think there is some, like, seed in me of that kid who used to watch the Ed Sullivan show, who wanted to, like, sort of entertain. Like, be Jack Carter or Jan
Murray.
Well, you
wanted to be a comedian.
But, like, I'd watch Hicks sometimes, and it'd be like, and it's funny looking back, that is, like, 20.
He could not get over on New York audiences. Like, there was what I always felt that. He was always angry, but they just, in a 15-minute chunk for a New York audience, I really think they're immediately like, what is he yelling? I mean, it was amazing to watch.
There were two guys, and I guess since I have, it doesn't really matter, but I always felt that, like, he pushed the you're not digging me card way too soon.
Yeah.
As I'm sure I did. But I think I did it just out of, like, you know, self-collapsing fear.
Yeah.
Just like, okay, this, you know, sweating and insecure and just like, oh my. But, like, I got a feeling, like, Bill, you know, this isn't a criticism because he was my buddy and he deserves all the, you know, acclaim he's gotten and, you know, since his death as well. But I always used to watch and go, like, you know, I think he's pushing this, like, you're not digging me card a little too soon.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that I did that as well.
Yeah.
But I think I was doing mine out of more fear, like,
well, yeah,
fear-based.
He wanted the distance, I think. I think he liked, you know, having this singular tone and having his own kind of time zone with things. Like, he sort of thrived on that. That, like, his, you know, his whole tone, the misanthropy of what he was doing was to establish his point of view. And I don't really believe... I think he was an amazing joke writer, and I think he knew that. And I really think he liked having that space to sort of, like, think out loud without worrying about that.
Right.
You know?
I tell you, one of my proudest moments was he came up to me at the bar one night at the Improv, and I guess it's kind of hard to believe that there was a time when, like, people were still listening to stuff on cassette tapes.
Yeah.
And I guess his new comedy album had come out.
Yeah.
And he came over to me and he handed it to me and he goes, hey, man, I just want to give you that. You really taught me a lot about comedy. And I was like, wow. It was like truly one of the most genuine, like, great compliments. Like, hey, yeah, that's right. My man, this, like, guy who really people really dig. You know, it really made, you know, there's like one of those things that you remember that go like, wow, man, that was special.
You know? Yeah. He used to like watching you.
Special.
I remember him sitting in the back of the room and he was the first guy that I think I told Brian Regan that, like, Brian Regan came in and Hicks came into the room and he's like, I love watching this guy. And I had to sit there and like in because he appreciated comedy. You know, Hicks did. But he was one of those guys where, you know, you'd see him and you'd be like, he was trying to work things out, man.
Right, yeah. Like, you know what's great, though? You just – Brian Regan, who I love Brian Regan.
Yeah.
As a guy, he was a great guy.
Yeah.
But he's a tremendous comedian.
Great.
And they never really seemed to be working a lot of stuff out. There was a guy who just had like – great material, and he did this kind of like he would get into this character, this kind of, and then he'd accent it at times. This really like insanely nerdy character, and the weirdos. And I mean, I haven't seen him in years, and I mean, once in a while, I'll see him on like Letterman and all. But I mean, there was a guy. See, there's the thing. He was almost like a true direct lineage of those guys that we were talking about, like the Ed Sullivan guys, the Tonight Show guys, Mike Douglas. Yeah. because there was no, like, you never saw Brian and thought, oh, boy, Brian's had a rough day.
I wonder if he's going to get over on the crowd tonight.
Yeah. Hey, let me tell you something. No matter how he does tonight, he's on his way to detox.
Yeah.
Let me tell you. There was never any of that, man. Guy would come in, and everybody would be happy.
Yeah.
He was like Hickey in Nice Man Cometh. He'd come in, and all the denizens of the bar would like, hey, Brian's here. You know, they'd go in, and it was like 20 minutes of joy watching like a really funny comedian. And you go... You'd laugh, and then he would go into the night. There was no like, hey, can you get me something? None of that.
No.
I had to cut him off. It was so refreshing.
Yeah. Well, I think we romanticized that shit. I mean,
way too much, man.
But let's go. But just out of curiosity, though. So, like, what was the beginning? When did you first come in and start doing comedy? How old were you?
Well, I moved to the city. I guess I was like. I want to say I was 19. I might have been like just turned 20. I went to college for like a year. I was like a year late getting out of high school.
Yeah.
Because I'd cut classes for like the better part of 3 years. So it took me like a year to like find. Then they had like what they called a free school.
Yeah.
It was like from the Billy Jack thing where it was like these hippie teachers in the early 70s who you'd sit around on like foam talking about your feelings. And I saw that and I went, oh, there's my ticket out. Because I went to like a community college, Nassau Community College. And I was going to be like an actor and all that. But I was always like funny. And I kind of knew that that's the thing I wanted to do. So I guess I was like about, maybe I just turned 20. And I just was like, you know, my father's coffee shop was now, there weren't really that many. It was just those guys hanging out. And like, those strippers from the Coach Car Inn across the road there. So I remember one day I just made up my mind, like I met a guy, he was like some old doctor, and he knew somebody in the village who'd rent me a room for like, I mean, it's like late, this is in the 70s, so it was like 30, 35 bucks a week.
Wow.
For like a furnished room.
Yeah.
So I was like, hey, you know what? I'm doing this.
Yeah.
So one day, I always remember this, there was these strippers, I forget, her name was Chrissy or something, and you know, like, when you're like 19 or 20 and you're still like, you know, maybe like you got some baby fat and a couple of people and some stripper, some jaded, it's like, you know, like, oh my God. So I was like trying to impress her. I told her like, you know, I'm moving to the city. I'm going to go after my, you know, be an actor. And she got so nervous. She butted out her cigarette and started screaming to my father, Nick, you better talk to this kid. He's out of his mind. He thinks he's getting on that train and he's going to go into the city and be an actor. And I was like, why is this scaring you so? You know what I mean? Like, and I realized, like, she probably had, like, some dreams that she could never. So I tell you, man, I had, like, some beat up. It's almost like, you know, like out of that Lou Reed song, standing on a corner, suitcase. Yeah. I mean, I hit the city. I had the room. I was working in some, like, bad jobs. And, you know, man, I went out and I just, like, did open mics and I sucked.
Where, like, in the village at the, where were
they?
Well,
this is like 70s, so, like, the places that even if I could remember their names, they've long, I would go to the improv, you could audition once a month.
Yeah.
Or you can go to the comic strip and audition once a month, or Catch, you could go once a week.
Yeah.
And I would go, and, like, in the early days, like, I wasn't even, like, modeling myself after, like, say, Rodney.
Yeah.
Do you remember? I'm sure you probably don't even remember this comedian, Jackie Vernon.
Yeah, I love Jackie Vernon.
He had that real deadpan. He would do those one.
With the slideshow.
Yeah.
I loved him.
Brilliant.
I loved him.
But the thing is, that was a subtle kind of thing that, like, a guy spends years developing that.
Yeah.
And I was, like, a 20-year-old kid who thought I was going to be, like, the next Jackie Vernon. I was writing all these one-liners.
It's so weird, because he was the first guy that really resonated to me. It's weird that you had
that. Did he really?
Yeah, I went and saw him with my parents when he came to Albuquerque, New Mexico, when I was, like, 11 or 12 years old. Because I was such a huge fan. And he was doing these lounges. You know, he did the Hilton Inn, the lounge at the Hilton Inn. And I was like, I begged my parents to take me, and they took me. And I sat right up front and watched Jackie Vernon, and it changed my life, you know?
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So then, yeah.
I know him, yeah.
So, but I was up there, man. I was trying to do these, like, one-liners, and it was just, it really was anything. But I started meeting some guys, like, do you remember a guy, I don't know if you'd know him, his name was Terry Day. Like, I was, like, 20, and I was sitting on line outside of Catch every Monday. You'd sit on line, or... And Terry Day was like about 40, 40-something. And he'd come in from San Francisco. And he was like kind of older and hipper. And he'd like watch me. And he'd go like, you know, you got something. It's not there yet, but like I think you. And you know, I just really couldn't put it together, man. And then I'd work like there was a buddy of mine, this guy Tom Saunders. I think he wound up writing like for Arrested Development, but we were like a comedy team.
Yeah,
and we were doing like sketches and all. And so we were at the comic strip. And then I got into some plays. I was doing some acting. And so then that was going to be the thing. Like I was going to be like Marlon Brando.
Right.
And then finally I started hanging out in the Village. Like just there was a – they're not there anymore. Well, the Bitter End is still there. But next to the Bitter End was a place called The Dugout.
Yeah.
And it was just this like funky beat up joint. And there was this woman named Rosie. And she was like a real big – heavy broad, and she would like she was like a real Village character, and she would run this Monday night show, and all these lunatics would go up, and my buddy Neil was the bartender there, and he goes, "Hey, I'll talk to Rosie, I'll put you up," and it was the first place. It's like it was sawdust on the floor, and like you know some drunken NYU kids, but I go up, and it was like the first place, like say around 81, 82, that I started feeling like I started developing a voice where like I'd have to go up with some jokes. But then what became funnier was the space between the jokes, the being on stage.
Yeah.
And around that time, a guy comes in one night and he goes, "Danny, I want you to meet my friend Rockets." Do you remember Rockets Red Glare?
Yeah.
So Rockets was watching me and he wanted to be a comedian.
Yeah.
So he's like, "Hey, man, maybe you could do some of these things with me in the East Village." So that... Like, I had this, like, sort of, like, little run in the East Village. Actually, you know who was hanging out? Remember Steve Buscemi?
Yeah.
Steve Buscemi?
Sure.
Was, like, a buddy with Rockets.
Yeah.
Oh, and then the big thing that really probably helped me, like, go from, like, being, like, this non-entity to being any sort of entity was that Dave Heenan was quite a character.
I remember him.
You remember Heenan?
Yeah.
So he came up to me. I knew Dave from the Village.
Yeah.
And he goes, "Danny, I'm going to federal prison. I need you to watch my gig." So he gave me, I took over the Tuesday night at the Bitter End, and it was just like, it was like the beginning of like my life, you know, because like it was like, they'd let me drink, I could drink, and because I was the MC and there was no real like, you know, I could go up there and it's like, do as much time as I wanted to, and so sometimes they would like the person booking the joint would ask me, like, "Can you put Dennis Blair on?" I'd be like, "Yeah, okay, put Dennis Blair on." But most of the time, it would be like, you know, it was just like guys trying to get on. And it'd be like, "Yeah, come on out, man, but I'll put you." And I actually had like a little following. And so all of a sudden, I'd be like on, you know, it's like it was a great stage too, man, because I had like room to move. And I was still kind of skinny.
Yeah.
I was like skinny in those days. Yeah. I was like kind of handsome. So like, you know. And it was like that first beautiful moment, that sweet spot where like booze is working for you. It's not working against you. The coke was coming around, but like you couldn't really afford to get too crazy anyway.
Yeah.
And like you just had this freedom because you didn't care.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And I did that for like about, I'd say a year, like every Tuesday. And I probably did like a couple of hours every Tuesday. And then I'd go do these other little... And guys would come up to me and go like, "Yo, man, you're really good. You should be like at the improv. Like you're better than a lot of guys at catching the improv." I was like, "Yeah, man, I should be at the improv."
Yeah.
So I walk by the improv and I look in through the window and I see Dom, who I knew from knocking around.
Dom Herrera, yeah.
So I walk in, I see Herrera, and he's talking to some like really skinny guy with like who's like pale, like almost like white skin, who looks like he's going to die. So, "Hey, Dom, hey, man, I saw you in the window. How you doing?" He's like, "Yeah, Danny." He goes, "Oh, here, you know David?" It was freaking David Bowie. He was talking to Bowie. And it was like, this is like around 82.
Yeah.
So I was like, "Oh, this is like the place. This, you know, I've got Steve Forbert hanging out at the Bitter End. This is like
Bowie's
hanging out with Bowie." You know? So, you know, I auditioned and... I'd really become a good comedian, like, you know, whatever.
Oh, no, yeah, yeah.
In my 20s, you know. And Silver would not pass me. The weird thing is that Silver Friedman, who ran the club, she wouldn't pass me. And I would go in. And what's weird was that all the guys who, like, were already at the improv knew me because they would come down to the other clubs that I was doing, like Sweeps and the Bitter End. try and get like spots that paid on the weekends. So they'd be like, when they'd bring me up on the audition night, they didn't bring me up. They'd be like, oh, this guy is one of my favorite comedians. And I'd go up, and I mean, like, I'm telling you, Mark, I would kill. I would, like, hammer. I would bang the room, and the woman would not pass me. And then, like, one night after just, like, I mean, like, annihilating the room, like, what? She just, like, sort of in a way that you're like, well, everyone else seems to think you're pretty funny. So she passed me. And to her credit, it's like, I don't want to paint, like, that bad a picture of her. Because she did, like, jump me right in. Like, usually if you passed in those days.
Yeah,
like,
you got to start late night.
In the 80s, yeah, it was, like, late night, you hang around. And, like, I kind of, she let me jump to the head of the line in a hurry.
Yeah.
Like, I almost immediately started, like, emceeing weekend shows and getting, like, good, like, you know, those 11, 10, 50 spots.
Yeah.
So I got going real quick. And it was just a matter of months. And then one night, this woman, Sherry Fortas, came in. She was looking at people for Lorne Michaels. It was called The New Show.
Right.
It was the show he was, the first show he was doing after he left SNL in 1980.
Right.
So this is like around 83.
Yeah.
So she came in. She caught me on a great night and called me into audition for Lorne. And talk about, you know, like when you say this isn't working. I remember going in. Like, everybody was there. It was, like, right around here. It was, like, 54th Street. There was, like, some big studio. So when I got to the audition, man, it was, like, you know, in the afternoon. And, you know, I'm, like, a night creature, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm, like, I'm there to audition for Lorne Michaels. And so there was everybody that you ever, but, like, not just, like, comedians. It was, like, Uncle Floyd was there. Yeah. It was, like, guys you saw, like, on cable, late-night cable TV.
Uncle Floyd, I think, is Jimmy Vivino's brother. Is that right? I mean, Uncle Floyd.
Sounds like it could be right.
The guitar player for Conan.
And I think he still performs in New Jersey.
He still has the show, right?
Is that, Floyd Vivino, Jimmy Vivino? Yeah. Yeah, that sounds right.
I think it is. I just learned that, like, 2 weeks ago over there.
Yeah, I guess I always, it was like one of those things you kind of knew.
Yeah, I did.
Like, you know, Justin Timberlake and Ryan Gosling were roommates when they were in the Disney.
Where
they were Musketeers. Yeah, that's crazy, right?
Yeah.
So they're all there. And I remember thinking, like, hey, I'm getting a little nervous, you know. This is, like, a big deal. Because, like, Lorne Michaels.
Yeah.
So I go downstairs, and there was a bar there. And I figure I'll just have, like, that one shot. And I did. I just had, like, a stiff shot of Jack Daniels. And then I went back up. And I remember, like, Alan Havey, who wound up getting the show. He was there, and he had a bit about, like, soap on a rope.
Yeah.
And he had the soap around his neck. And I was like, yeah, I'm not doing any props for this. I'm just going to go in. It's like, so again, this is like the first time that being like the guy who thinks he's going to work the moment.
Yeah.
So I go into this room, and it wasn't just Lorne Michaels. It was literally like all these people that you kind of like revered from like not only SNL, but like SCTV, like Dave Thomas.
Yeah.
And I think Candy might have been there. And pretty sure Penny Marshall was there. And there's just all these people, Buck Henry.
Yeah.
It was like all these guys that like you'd grown up
in the
like,
audience.
Just like sitting
at
this like sort of big desk with Lorne.
Yeah.
So I got up and somebody said, oh, this is Dan Vitale, blah, blah, blah. And I said, hey, it's great. Yeah, guys, you know, I was coming down. And I started to try and get that rhythm going. And then I was, because my material never was just like, oh, here's the material. You had to work in organically.
Yeah.
You know, hey, man, you know, I woke up today, and it's like, yeah, so I'm going to audition for. And I started doing the thing, and they were not reacting at all. They were just staring blankly. And it only took like a minute or two, and I just went, hey, you know what? I got a better idea. Why don't all you fucking people go fuck yourselves, man. I grabbed my jacket. I went, yeah, shove it. Are you going to sit there, fucking stare at me? Go fuck you, man. And I walked out, and I was like punching the elevator. And Sherry Fortas came out, and she went, Dan, you know, she had seen me at the improv, killer. He was like, oh, here's my new find.
Yeah.
And she went, what happened? I went, I don't know. She goes, Dan, Lorne had told everybody to not react because they would burn themselves out laughing, trying to laugh at everybody, and it would come off disingenuous. So that's why they weren't. But they were listening to you. And I went, I'm so. I went home, and I was just like, my first big audition. So then, like, I don't know. It might have been like Pat Buckles was like managing, and I don't know, whatever it was. I got somebody to call Sherry and explain that Dan was, you know. So they actually let me come back and audition again. And for some reason, the second time, like, I just kind of like, I did a spin on what I had done.
Right.
And what a jerk I'd been. And now I was like really kissing up to them.
Yeah.
And it was another one of those like sort of improv moments, but this time it worked.
Right.
And I just saw Lauren kind of like nodding, like, okay, now I get you.
Yeah.
And he actually, I mean, I wound up doing the new show, and I did a pilot for my own sitcom with Joe Mantegna called Big Shots in America. And then I got hired for his first season back. But he was actually sort of like my mentor for like, I'd say like two and a half years, where like I would be up at his office like almost every week. He'd have me up to his apartment. He was taking me out. He got me some development money from NBC to not go work anywhere. So it was like the first like real time of my life.
What'd
you
learn from him though when you sat and talked to him? I mean, what was the impression?
You know, one thing that jumps out at me that it's funny coming from this conversation that I always remember was like, because, you know, like the other night, me and you were talking on the phone real quick, and I just went like, Mark, I'd love to do the podcast, but the sooner the better, because I fold under pressure.
Right.
Like, if I have another day to think of it, I may think of a reason that I can't do. So Lauren would say to me, like, sometimes when, like, I would, like, he'd go, you know, he'd see me, he'd come to the improv all the time, and he'd bring in people, and he'd come in, like, a lot. And he said, you know, man, he goes, really great comedians got to stand up there and take the bullets. And I don't think you're ready to, you know what I mean? Like, you're not there yet. You don't just take the bullets. You, like, fold under the bullet. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, like in a great cop movie, the guy's, like, shooting it out.
Yeah.
Like, I'm the guy who, as soon as he got shot
at. Stumbling
like,
the gun.
Yeah, so, like, you know, Barney Fife or something, you know, like, with the, yeah. So, like looking back, that was really, it's something that I always remembered because like I, you know, like even like at Rocky Sullivan's, I get up there and I go like, I know I'm going to do like close to an hour and I know I'm going to wind up having fun, but these first 10 minutes are going to be dreadfully painful.
Yeah.
I just got to get through. I have to like, you know what I mean? And that's something I couldn't do when I was younger, but, what did I learn from him? You know, looking back, he was a great guy, and he really, I've thought about him a lot over the years. It's like, you know, there was the first guy who really made me feel special. Like, you know what I mean? Like, really said, like, you know, you got something special. And he really tried to give me opportunities. In terms of mentoring, no, he didn't, you know, he didn't have anything to offer.
Right.
You know, like, you would think that he might have been a guy who'd seen all these guys come. You gotta understand, this was the 80s. I'm sure that, like, some of the people that he had to deal with hadn't come later. Like, you know, the Chris Farleys and guys like that. So, I don't know. It was like that feeling of special, like feeling like you have a unique talent. You deserve to be doing this. It's kind of like, I tell you, man, I've made peace with it. I made peace with it a long time ago. But I can't help but think sometimes, I mean, Mark, I'm not saying this, like, out of, like, you know, I was, like, I got into the candy store. I didn't get up the ladder to that, like, nice jar with all the real, but, man, I got into the store. I have a friend of mine who uses that metaphor. He goes, nah, you really got, like, more, like, to the window. You were, like, we're close, but you're looking in. But, like, I kind of felt like I got into the store, and I just didn't have it to, like, get up that ladder to the thing. But I got into the, I think I feel like that I got into a door that a lot of guys never get in that door, so I should be very grateful.
You know? Right.
And I've often thought this, and I don't know. Maybe
but what exactly happened? So you did the pilot, you did the show, and then you're signed up to be a featured player on SNL.
Okay.
When what did happened the fucking was, wheels come off?
You know, sad. The wheels came off almost immediately. No one saw, I guess the wheels came off. I must have had the donut on because I managed to, when you're really looking back at where I was at, the fact that I got a couple of year run, Lauren was doing that show, the new show.
Yeah.
And so, like, I guess, like, me and Havy were, like, the guys who nobody ever knew of. And then he had all these guys like Candy and Dave Thomas, Buck Henry. So they would work us into sketches. And then, like, but for some reason, Lauren, like, you know, bring me into the office. And I just remember one day, like, we were making, like, After Scale. And this guy came over and said, hey, Dan, I'm Jim, blah, blah, blah. I'm one of the associate producers. Lauren wants to offer you a contract. It's going to be $1,500 a week. And you're, it's like, you know, I was making $15, you know.
Yeah.
So I had had, like, a little coke problem at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, the first thing that happens when you're not making money and you have a little coke problem and then you're making a whole bunch of money at once, you suddenly have a big coke problem, man. And I was like, but it's funny, like, I've always been, like, thought, like guys like me and you, say, for example, we're kind of hip. Like, we get the types.
Yeah.
We see the people. We go, like, man, I would never be like this. Did you see this showbiz asshole
over here? Yeah,
yeah. This prima donna walking in from his limo. The minute I was making the bread, I was starting to get, like, a little TV time, I became, like, the biggest, like, you know, like, walk in, like, hey, how are the boys doing tonight? Yeah, going to do your little 20 minutes? Yeah. Am I on? You know, I'd be like, wah, wah. Like, you know, like looking back, like, what, you know, like, what did spots pay? In the, if you really think about it, like, so say it's, like, the 1980s. I think he made like $10 a night at the Improv, which everybody takes the 10.
Yeah.
Like Seinfeld would take the 10.
Yeah.
He might tip a waitress or something, but nobody ever turned down the car. So he'd come in and be working on the show, come in and be like, oh, can I get on? Yeah, all right. Yeah. It's like, yeah, put Dan on. He's doing some TV.
Yeah.
And I'd go in the bathroom and I'd be like, wah, wah. And I realized I would probably spend like $100
just to get on stage,
just for like a $10 set.
Yeah.
And then like call the Comedy Cellar, you know, talk to, you know,
Manny,
Rick Chrome. Oh, yeah. Rick, and he's, I'm in a cab. So I'd jump in a cab and I'd be like, hey, look the other way. And I realized like I'd make $25 a night doing comedy and spend like, you know, hundreds of dollars running around. Kind of was fun, but, so the new show, I remember it was the lowest rated show that year on television. In fact, Miami Vice took its time slot. So then Lauren called me in the office and said, listen, I'm going to get you some money from NBC. It's like development money. You know, at the time it was pretty good. It really wasn't that much money.
Yeah.
Like, it was like 20, 25 grand, something like that. So he wound up, he was going to produce a pilot. And it was called Big Shots in America. And James Burrows directed it. Bernie Brillstein. I mean, like, all the heavyweights were there. This thing looked like it was, like, going to be a monster. Mantegna was in it. Christine Baranski, whatever. Good people. And the thing just, it just didn't work. So, but I made a lot of money, like, you know, relative at the time.
Sure,
doing that. But you know what? By the time we did the pilot, man, I'd already started, like, I'd already started falling apart. Like, it had swung the other way.
Yeah.
Where, like, the booze had, like, taken over. It wasn't just like, okay, he's a little crazy, this is fun. It's like, nah, this guy's really, like, uncomfortable to be around. And, like, he did sign a contract and we have to pay him, so we might as well use him. And I remember, like, shooting that pilot, man, up at 8H. We shot the pilot at 8H. And I remember, like, I just was, like, you know, not doing that. I mean, it was like shooting a pilot in front of a live audience to begin with was, like, a different. I'd been in plays and I'd acted, but, like, this was it. And, like, Lorne, whatever he nurtured and mentored as, like, a comedic, he wasn't, like, a people guy.
Yeah.
Like, people would say, like, you know, I've never seen him lose his mind at people or except with you. And he would just, like, be screaming, like, you know, from behind a camera. There'd be a red light on a camera. And he'd be like, just do the fucking lines, goddamn. You know, and then, like, I remember Joe Mantegna, who I still, to this day, he'd come over and go, like, hey, man, screw that. Just look in my eyes. We do this, you know?
Yeah.
And I do remember, like, I mean, it was hell. It was really hell. And that guy, Jim Burrows, who's, like, arguably one of the most successful producer directors in sitcom history.
Yeah,
that guy, I'm pretty sure he loathed me from the moment, you know, like he got well, stuck with me.
What were you doing? You were just improvising or you were just not?
No, it was a sitcom. I was like the Fonzie character. I was like the Fonzie guy. You know, it was
so
like.
What was the fundamental problem? That you, what were you not getting?
Oh, because I was like, I was drunk. Let's put it this way. I was drunk at night and then coming into rehearsal scared.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I started getting yelled at, I'd go out and get drunk. So at a certain point, all I knew was there was a red light there. And I see. Oh, and this is the weird thing, man. I guess because Lorne had never produced a sitcom.
Yeah.
He had guys with I remember him arguing with Jim Burrow. Or I heard that they were arguing because he had guys with cue cards there. And, like, I heard someone go, like, no, nobody does cue cards in a sitcom, man. That's, like, live TV stuff and all. But somehow or another, I'm sure this is one of the few sitcoms that was ever shot where a guy was actually holding cue cards. Like you would if you were doing. You know what the weird thing is? I actually have a copy of it somewhere.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, years ago, my friend Chris Murphy.
Yeah, I remember Murphy. Is he all right?
Yeah, he's good.
Okay.
He had some problems. He pulled through, man.
Good.
Yeah, he's a good guy. So I just remember going to his apartment. I said, hey, man, I haven't looked at this since, this is like 8 years later or something. So we put it in the, I guess it was like a VHS in those days. And I went, well, you're about to watch a man in complete blackout drunk perform a sitcom shot before a live audience at 8H Studio. And we watched the thing, and the credits roll, Joe Mantegna, Dan Vitale. And we watched the thing, and it wasn't great. But I tell you, the weird thing is, you almost wouldn't know that I was drunk. Like, I was just thinking, I mean, I know, Jim Burrows, I'm sure if you were interviewing him next and he walked in the door, he'd probably turn around. If he remembered me, probably wouldn't remember. But here's the weird thing, man. You would have thought that that would have brought everything down to a screeching halt. A couple of months, Lorne announced he was going back to take SNL over in 1985. And I went up to the offices, and he made me audition with, like, everybody. But it's like the cast that year was, like, Robert Downey Jr. And Randy Quaid. It was great. And I showed up, like, here's the weird thing. I think I showed up drunk at one of the auditions. And yet, he called me to the office, and I remember sitting in the office. So this is, like, the fall of 1985. So.
Yeah.
And he went, all right, tell Downey's agent $3,000 a week. See if you could do, you know. Yeah, Robert was like 20 years old.
Yeah.
You know, so he's like, all right. And then he looked at me and he went, Dan, in the words of the Kennedy brothers talking about LBJ, I'm hiring you. I'd rather have you inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in.
And what did that mean to you?
I guess it meant, like, I've spent a couple of years trying to develop stuff with you. Now I've got this thing I'm doing. And if I don't hire you, it would be just my luck for you to be to hit on some other venue and attack me.
Right.
And so, like, he still believed in me enough that way.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was really weird, man. It was like almost like because, and I wasn't probably doing so much to dissuade everybody, but, like, I showed up, man. And, you know, like, Lovitz had his desk, and, you know, he was like, oh, you know, he was a great guy, Robert Smigel.
He
was, like, the only guy who would talk to me. Like, he had a little office with this guy, John Schwartzfelder.
It
was, like, wound up being one of the original Simpsons guys. And Smigel was just, like, a new guy there. And, like, you know, like, my desk was, like, it was, like, almost like I was loitering, you know, like, I was there. And then, like, I'd go get drunk. No one was really including me in. So then I go in, I talk to Smigel.
He's a sweet guy, Smigel.
And then you know who else was up there who I became pretty good friends with at the time? Remember, you know, Bruce McCullough?
From the Kids in the Hall?
Yeah, Mark McKinney. For some reason, just those two guys from the Kids in the Hall were hired as writers. But they were like complete raw rookies. I'd just go like, we'll go hang out with the kids, man. And then like all the film guys, like... James Signorelli had the film unit. And I knew that the film guys had like a refrigerator with beer. So like if I'd run through my money, and I'd go like hang out with the film. Hey, guys, what are you shooting? That's great. You mind? So, well, and I remember like Madonna was hosting the first show. And I guess she had married Sean Penn just not long before that. So these guys really dug me, McCullough and McKinney. Yeah. You know, they were just getting started.
Yeah.
And they wrote a sketch for me with Madonna as this, like, Avon guy who, like, has a date with her.
Yeah.
And they came to me and they went, you know, man, Lorne just went. Like, in other words, and, you know, justifiably so. He didn't trust me. Like, I wasn't somebody he was pushing. I had, you know what I mean? I hadn't earned any trust. It was like, this guy, we don't know. So I got, like, some things written for me. And they never really got past dress rehearsal, man.
Right.
And then I just, within like a matter of weeks, it was like, you know, wherever my alcoholism was at, you know, it just all caved in, man. Yeah. And I went to my very first fall of 85, late 85, I wound up at Regent Hospital on East 61st Street. And actually, I was getting fired. I remember I went into the office. Because I'd actually written a film at the time. I'd co-written a film with this buddy of mine. Lorne was actually interested in producing, possibly. So he got us some money from some producers.
Yeah.
But he was, like, so convinced at that point that I was, like, becoming more and more trouble and untrustworthy that he got me money just to walk away from it. So, like, I wound up, like, getting paid just to let the other guy go do the rewrite and whatever would go. Remember Gary Weiss, the guy who shot the films?
Yeah.
So I remember Weiss would come up to me because I guess he'd had some issues. He was like, dude, you're like gone, man. You know, it was great. Robert Downey Jr. And I haven't seen him in years. But he was like, he was almost like, he was really like a great young guy. And he'd be like, man, you're messed up. Let's go. Because like we'd go to like a cast party the first week with that, like the Odeon.
Yeah.
And I remember like I was getting in a fight with like, you know, telling Pee Wee Herman to go fuck himself. Yeah, go fuck you. And like they were trying to throw me out of the party.
Yeah.
And I remember Downey jumping in the cab with me going, hey, I'm sticking with you, man. You know, and then we would go to some like after hours club. He was a great guy. I didn't, who would have ever guessed what was going to become? He was just. Yeah, it's
this
like,
is kid.
You're nuts, man. You know, you know I remember like when Pee Wee Herman hosted, it was like the second show. I just remember how they didn't throw me out of the building. I don't know. But I just remember like, I guess Phil Hartman was like actually like sort of like his right hand guy.
Yeah.
Like they had worked together or something. So Hartman wasn't a cast guy. And I just remember being so drunk. Like I was on my back in the writer's room and like looking up and seeing Paul Rubens. And this guy, Phil Hartman, sitting there, and I just remember babbling something. And at that point, like, I kind of got to the point where I would just be, like, getting drunk, and guys would just be, like, walking over me.
Yeah.
Like oh, no, he does that. He gets drunk. He lays. Don't worry about it, you know. And, you know, like, and then, like, I'd see Al Franken, who was, like, the producer. Yeah. And, you know, like, so I was getting the warnings, like, you know, man, you're really, like, out of control here. And then finally, like, there was one show where, like, I think I, like, stayed in my dressing room and I didn't show up for a sketch.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay. So I was getting fired. You got to understand, this is 1985, so it's a different reference than now. I had somehow heard the word rehab. I didn't even really completely understand what it was. So Lorne was like, listen, this is, you'll get paid for the first 13. And I just looked across the desk and I went, not knowing what a rehab really was, I went, what if I went into rehab? And he went, oh, well, that's another story. And then, like, I guess Gary Weiss had been in rehab. He came in. So I had after insurance. And the next thing you know, I was in, like, some, like, high end. And I remember thinking, like, and that's where the line comes from, buddy.
The hitting bottom?
Because it was 1985. I had a cashmere coat. I had, like, thousands of dollars. I was getting checks sent to the rehab, being kept in the safe. And I really thought I was hitting bottom. And in a weird way, at that time I was. But like, you know, I was still in my 20s. I still had my physicality.
Yeah.
You know, I was under contract to like arguably the biggest comedy show in the country.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I thought like, oh boy, this is it. You've become the gutter. This is it. Yeah. And you know what? I don't know, man. Maybe it was easier to embrace the idea of being a failure in that moment and like going, hey, I'm a drug addict, I'm an alcohol, than it was to actually like face the fear of what it took. I mean, because I was privy to like you know, top psychiatrists, and you know, they brought AA meetings in and CA meetings, and it's like I was given. I intellectually got it. Yeah. I intellectually understood. This is what I need to do now,
right?
To not be blowing up this part of my life intellectually, but the intellectuality didn't do me any good.
Right. No,
I hadn't
yeah.
gotten it.
I completely know? Understand that. I was yeah. talking about that with somebody the other day. Like, you can understand something, but you can't engage it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I get that.
Yeah. But
the other thing.
You hadn't processed it. You hadn't really, yeah.
Well, you're still not dealing with the sickness,
right.
you know?
Right. Right. Well, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, I get it, but can I get a line?
Oh.
I understand.
I can't tell you how many guys I say, well, I wouldn't even say sad to say, because I'm, the fact that I'm sitting here with you in this lovely room with these, you know, doing this interview, and that I'm 57 and I still smoke cigarettes.
Yeah.
And the fact that I'm alive, that so I can't say sad to say or, oh,
right.
it's a messed up story. I'm thrilled that I made it through all that, because I'll tell you something, man. Any of these, like, scripts I'm working on, if they get finished, we don't know. That's all a crapshoot,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know? Or will I start performing again? Somebody be like, hey, quite a character. Let's throw him in that sitcom or
yeah.
throw him in that film. Yeah, it could happen. But, you know, like, guys who always, you always hear about guy like, oh, yeah, he's a... He's playing the part of a guy who's, so he's spending some time downtown. It's like, you know, man, all that time that I wasn't like performing
yeah.
and like making it in show business, the characters I've met, the darkness I've seen, I don't need any more prep work. It's like, oh, yeah, you want me to be that guy? Yeah, I got you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I always hear about some actor, like, oh, Ryan Gosling
yeah, yeah.
Was hanging out in a tiki bar in Florida because he wanted to see what people. He was like, "Oh, really? He needed to study that, huh?" I got five guys' numbers. I call you right now. They're that, yeah.
They're that
you know
guy.
What I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
And I had a few people over the years who always say to me, like, "You know, man, you romanticize your darkness too much," and it's like, you know, they may have had a point. They may or may not have had a point. But I will tell you, I wouldn't trade in one moment of all the friggin' people that I met, the demi-monde, as the French would say.
Yeah.
You know what I'm
yeah.
saying? Like, it was like almost worth having to go through all that.
Yeah.
To see that side of life that like, if you'd planned it, you never would have.
No, you would have just pretended. Or you
yeah,
would have lived
yeah.
through someone else's life.
Right.
You had a life.
Yeah, so now the only thing is staying alive to friggin', you know, talk about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're alive, man. You're doing good.
Yeah. This was great, man.
Thanks
I
for
really,
talking
thanks
to me.
Thanks for, this is like, I mean, I got to be honest with you. Other than Charlie Rose, this was like, I've always sought myself like at my lowest moments. I always watched Charlie Rose and thought, man, if I could just get it together,
to
have a project.
To
I don't know why. And I'm not always even that impressed with everything he says, but it's yeah. just something about that table.
Yeah.
But this was like,
yeah, well,
this
close.
Was the thing.
Oh, good.
No, man. This was the thing. Yeah, thanks for having me on, brother. This
it's great
fantastic.
To see you, man. I'm glad you're doing well.
Thanks, buddy.
Love him. Love it. I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, man.